Hello, and welcome to AMO Kenzoku, episode 49. We are a group of four Bubblegum Crisis Boomer otaku who wanted an excuse to talk about anime, manga, and any related subjects we find interesting. The Kenzoku are...
Hey, I'm Nick.
Yo, I'm Sam.
Hey, all, I'm Mike.
And I am Dylan, your host for tonight. This episode is being recorded on April 4th, 2024. Today we will be discussing the 1984 U.S. film Streets of Fire. There'll be spoilers throughout for the movie, and with that, Hashin! So, as usual, before getting into the main topic, we'll take our side. A couple things here. Randomly, one of my Buffalo area local theater now is doing an end of EVA showing, where they've got it showing for like a week, like with an evening showing, and on the weekend two shows. So I'm pretty excited by that. So I got tickets to go see it again.
That's cool.
Yeah. Nice. And I was like, oh, I guess that other little showing did well enough that either G Kids was like, hey, anyone else want to do this thing? Or I don't know. I don't know how anything gets into a theater ever, but I was pretty excited. So I got a ticket. The only annoying thing for me is the show's at like 9 or 9:30 at night or something, which is, you know, that's late for an old man like me. But
well,
you know,
it's late for all of us.
I'll stay up for that to go see it again. I'm tempted to buy tickets for like every night and then just go to as many as I can, but oh, I probably am not going to do that. And on another theatrical thing, I saw looking. I think it's April 19th, Spy Family Code White is coming to U.S. theaters.
Oh yeah, to get my tickets for that.
Yeah, I didn't quite understand what that was, because I just playing in Street Fighter 6, they had the Spy Family like Code White cross promotion for a while,
right.
And I was like,
oh yeah,
oh okay, what's that? I was like, I don't know. And then after a while, I realized, I was like, oh, that's a game. Or not a game, that's a movie. So I was like, okay. Does anyone know anything about that movie at all? Or
it's Spy Family. That's all I know. It's I know nothing about it other than that.
Okay. That's kind of where I was at. I went back and watched another couple episodes of the first season, and I was like, you know what? This show's actually pretty fun. I think I actually liked it better when I picked it back up. Maybe it was something with where I was at, where Anya was starting to get involved with the school kids, and I was like, okay, this is actually kind of entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. Speaking of Anya, random factoid, I forgot her name, but VA for Anya is also VA for Frieren.
Oh, yeah, I found that out recently.
Yeah, pretty good range. I mean, very, very different characters, so quite impressive. Yeah.
Definitely riding that hot train right now with two of the hottest characters that everyone's like, oh man, Frieren, yeah. and Anya. Okay, yeah, I gotta try and see if I'm interested enough, and it seems like it's actually getting a pretty reasonable U.S. release. Like I found it on the Regal app showing at like I think a bunch of the different kind of local theaters around here for at least some showings. It wasn't like a Fathom event thing. It was a little bit more like Suzume, maybe not quite as big as that, but
they've got it on IMAX at my theater.
Oh man, that's fancy. I gotta see if that's doing. I definitely gotta see if I can get out there. So for anyone who, I never know when these episodes are coming out in relation to these things, but we always say it, and it's kind of fun to record these things with the date, and then you listen to the episode and you're like, no, I missed the cool thing. Which is kind of fun.
Looks like this one will make it before it's out.
Okay, so
that week, so
you now have like you'll listen to the episode and then immediately have to be driving to the theater to go see it. Unrelated to that entirely, from two episodes ago, I apologize. Not last episode, it was fine, but two episodes ago, I apologize for my voice. I was getting over COVID and my voice was incredibly crazy sounding like a 13-year-old, so that was great.
No apology necessary. I mean, I feel like it's that time of year where everybody's catching something. So,
yeah, this week it's my turn.
probably good, at least for the listeners to know that, yeah, hey, something was going on there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was really great, but I didn't want to push off that episode at all because I was so excited by it.
So, yeah, apologies to the listeners for sounding somewhat worse than usual this week. But I'm a bit under the weather, too.
Sam, I had a question on your Crunchyroll store endeavors, because I know you've been battling that for a while. I was curious, like, is it worked at all or not? Or is it just randomly just dying all over the place for you specifically? They don't want you to spend any more money?
I do not understand, because it's crazy. Like, I decided I wanted to spend like hundreds of dollars there, and they don't want my money for some reason. I don't know what it is. Initially, it was I would order on their site, and it tell me and my order was complete, and it would give me an order number and say thank you, but I would not get a confirmation email. And then like days later, I would get an email that says, "Hey, you didn't finish checking out." Then there was a button in there like, click here and you can finish checking out. And I would click it and it would take me to their website and would say, your card is empty. And it was doing this for like a week. And then I tried on my phone eventually on a whim, and that worked. So I was able to buy some stuff. And the whole time on this though, like I'm messaging their customer service and I'm like, hey, this isn't working for me. What's going on? Like, oh, hey, give me your order number. And I give them my order number and they say, oh, there's no order like that in our system. I'm like, okay. I did like my order history is like probably got like 3 or 4 of these orders that are just totally dead sitting there.
That's
useless.
So weird.
Yeah.
That's wild.
And I recently got a new bug. Now I can't even buy stuff on my phone. Like
you're trying to do the fry, shut up and take my money.
Yeah,
and they're just refusing you.
Clearly, CR does not want your filthy anime boomer money.
And it sucks too, because like I started doing this, getting a little bit of FOMO, where I was like, this stuff might go out of stock, so I should order it now. And sure enough, Konosuba Season 1 went out of stock while I'm trying to do this thing and unable to buy it. So like,
oh man,
I'm kind of hoping it comes back in stock. But now I'm like extra anxious about getting some of these things. It's annoying that I can't buy stuff because the order form doesn't finish loading. And apparently they know about this issue, but maybe it's, I don't know how it's localized, but like Dylan apparently is able to order fine. So I don't know what's going on.
I blame Cloudflare.
Oh yeah.
I blame Cloudflare and session affiliation, and something has lost its mind over there. But that's because I work on a kind of a weird e-commerce site. So
yeah,
I know these things. They're terrible.
Tell you what, Sam, if I happen to run into the season 1 Japanese Blu-rays, I'll snatch them up for you over if I see it like at a secondhand store or something.
Well, what I really want is, oh man, I don't want to get too started. Did we talk about Recreators on the podcast?
You did.
No. No, I don't.
I know. Oh, wait, not off podcast. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, go with that.
Recreators was this series that came out on, it aired on Amazon in the US only. It never had a physical release over here. And in Japan, it had a release, physical release. But they never, And just, I think maybe tomorrow is the last day it's going to be on Amazon before it gets removed. And then because there was never a physical release, nobody will be able to watch it in English again unless you have stream rips from Amazon. That's a show that I've been considering buying, the R2s or whatever, RAs as they are now. But yeah, it's a shame. Maybe if you see that, definitely give me that. I think that Konosuba will probably come back in stock. I'm not as worried about that one.
Yeah, because what I'm seeing for Recreators individual Blu-rays, they are definitely priced like old R2s. Holy moly. Each disc is like $70.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm not that anxious.
Yeah, I was about to say, you know, if you really want, I don't know how many discs it'll be, but I'm assuming typical 2 eps per standard.
So. Yeah, no. Don't like
they
don't
like buying Full Metal Panic on imports.
That's a thing that I am trying to get rid of. So that's my trials and tribulations of trying to spend money.
Yeah, that's such a weird thing. And I had some of the same thing with I ordered a couple things. Oh, another thing that's out and we might end up doing something on eventually is I haven't watched it yet, but it seems like they did a very nice job. There was a theatrical release in 4K of Paprika.
Oh yeah, I
want to know. Satoshi Kon. Oh, yeah, I have not watched it, but they released it on a 4K Blu-ray digital disc. So I haven't watched it yet, but I'm sure it'll look nice. And it seems like they only did it released it like that because they actually did put in the effort to do some work on it. I don't know whether they went back to the whole source and everything, but there's a whole documentary that was called that I haven't watched yet either. It's called Restoring Paprika that's in 4K on the disc. So my hope is that they're like, oh yeah, we went back to all the original source and like rescanned in everything and, you know, did everything as original as they could, which would be super awesome. So that is a sale thing you can purchase in the US, which is pretty cool.
I hope it's not a thing of they just contracted with one of those people who runs those awful YouTube channels that do the AI 60K.
Oh, God.
4K, 60K.
That would be literally the worst.
Garbage.
Man, I can only imagine how good that movie would look on with an HDR compatible display.
Yeah. Oof. So I'll pop it in at some point when I'm not doing a million other things and watch. The other thing that I got that I have also haven't dug into it yet, but it looks really the same is the because I also didn't want it to run out of print. I got some serious FOMO was the EVA 3.0 plus 1.0 limited edition Blu-ray. And
oh, yeah.
It literally looks like it's the same packaging as the one I got from Japan.
It looks really close. I did some.
Yeah.
I haven't picked up the JP one, but it does look really, really close. I have the US one as well. And I was like, I'm totally happy with how it looks. They didn't use any. It's like completely white. It's slipcover.
Yep.
It's, you know, just very clean, you know, traditional. I mean, EVA does not need graphics to sell, right? It's EVA. Yeah. Like, the name alone is all you need.
So. Literally, I would love just a black box with the letters, just the plain logo on it. I'd buy that in a second.
I mean, obviously some, you know, kind of like limited edition ownership flexing here, but to date, one of my favorite looking things still is the EVA monolith box, like the cardboard box with the black sticker with the red text on it that says Neon Genesis Evangelion. I'm like, yeah, I'm looking at it right now. I'm still so glad that I so foolishly purchased that.
I think that thing held its value pretty well. Even in Japan, if you try and buy those, they're I think they're pretty expensive still.
True. Really?
I think so. I usually check in on those when I go. I like to peek in and see what they're doing. But if I remember right, it's still got pretty good value.
Yeah, it's so hard to say with those things. And I definitely also ended up with the FOMO thing, and I ended up getting some like kind of used copy of Nia Under 7 Blu-ray because I was like, what the hell? Like it sucks these days because you're like, okay, like. It's hard to say. Like, I don't know. It's not like it's worse than it was before, but I think it feels worse because you're like, this show, like, there's no reason for Nia Under 7 to not, like, exist and not be viewable and purchasable.
Yeah.
Agreed.
But, it's
streaming, I fear a lot of anime is going to turn into this, right, in, like, the next decades when physical media is continually phased out.
And then Sony's just going to decide, oh yeah, we don't, like, you know, they'll do the, like, anime's a low, the only thing that might be keeping some more of these shows up is that it is kind of, it's such a low cost thing per show or whatever to get stuff is my guess. And certainly is versus, like, you know, a major U.S. film, but, you know, you could see plenty of stuff going the way of that, what, the Warner Brothers Catwoman movie that they, you know, it spent $200 million on, and just like, yeah, we're just going to shelve this thing and show it because we want the tax break. Or stuff like on Disney Plus, the Willow TV series that was up and was streaming for like less than a year, and they literally just pulled it entirely from the service, just disappeared it.
Huh.
I don't understand though, like, I feel like it's to their benefit to just have this stuff streaming. Like, unless they do plan to do some kind of Disney Vault type thing, which I don't think they have the foresight to do.
That,
like, it's just better. Like, it's better for Crunchyroll, it's better for the anime companies. Like, just make that stuff available streaming. I wouldn't feel as bad about not being able to buy a physical copy if I knew that I could watch it somewhere, right? Like,
yeah,
it's a shame that, like, I have these thoughts some days, like, oh, I want to watch blah, or I want to tell somebody, hey, you should go watch blah, like Nia Under 7. It's like, hey, we think people should go watch this, but like, where? Nowhere.
Yeah, it's like, here, let me give you my thumb drive that has a copy of it, and now you have to watch it on thumb drive. A lot of people are just like, oh, I'm not going to do that.
Or it really does kind of, it props up piracy, right? Like, it keeps a reason for that stuff to keep shuffling around, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing, too, is it's like, yeah, if you had these legit ways to have that stuff, there wouldn't ever be a need for those other things. But I think Nia Under 7's a great example, because it's not a super well-known show, but it's one I would love to be able to tell, like, because I think there's certain people that you'd be like, oh, you don't really like anime, but you like this sort of thing? Dude, watch this show. It's really cool, and I think you'd really like it.
Yeah.
But I can't be like, oh, so where do I watch it? And be like, come to my house and I'll let you borrow my DVDs. And they'll be like, DVDs? I don't have a DVD player. You'll be like,
what's
that?
What? A DVD okay. now?
Yeah.
So sad.
So, yeah, those problems aren't limited to the, you know, they certainly aren't limited to the anime industry. In some ways, anime has been, I think, actually better than a lot of the others. Just because most series get at least some sort of disc release.
True.
And a lot of the older ones have had one, such that you can get it often. And for the ones that are really weird and obscure, there's not enough licensing money to care about it, such that you can find them on the Seven Seas or just up on YouTube these days. What I was going to say. Oh, I wanted to take one other slight detour into winter season.
Mm-hmm.
And into a couple of different shows. I still haven't watched the last episodes. I think most shows are still have their last episode or two to air. Mm-hmm. So I haven't finished anything, but I've watched a bunch of them, and Bravern is top tier. That show is fabulous.
Yeah. Weirdly.
It has kept being really cool and interesting and taken a bunch of tropes and things that I think could have just been, oh man, this is just gross or terrible. And actually made it really cool. So bravo, Masami Obari. Mm-hmm. And bravo, Bravern. You're an awesome show.
Sounds relatively popular just kind of looking around a little bit.
Well, that's good. You know, it's always good when there's a show that actually is cool and interesting and is a little bit weird that you wouldn't necessarily go to from the key art. But then... you know, more people are like, hey, actually, hang on a sec, this show is actually really cool.
Yeah.
I think the other one that I'll put in this surprise positive category is Snack Basue.
Weirdly, I agree, yeah.
Yeah, like, it's not a great show, but it's kind of, I always watch it, and I'm like, yeah, you know what, this show it's fun trash, and it kind of is trashy, and it kind of makes fun of itself and not, and... you know, you always get to hear some fun 80s J-pop song at the end of the episode that I didn't know about. And, you know, sometimes the people that are karaokeing it are trying to be professional. So they actually do like the shifting of the key in the song on the karaoke machine to make it match their voice better.
Oh, nice.
It's complete trash, but it's good trash. It's good garbage.
That show surprised me in the way that, like, I watched one episode, you know, just to check it out, because I couldn't resist with that premise. But it's a show that, I mean, I haven't watched a lot, but I come back to because I'll sit down and I'm like, I want to watch something. And I just feel kind of overwhelmed with everything. And like having to worry about following a plot and all that stuff. And I'm just like, you know, I kind of just want to zone out and kind of enjoy something easy. And Snack Bossaway is like the thing that I gravitate towards is like, yeah, I know this will be entertaining and funny and I won't have to think too hard. So yeah, I'll just throw that on.
Yeah, it's basically Friends or it's basically it's Cheers. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. Cheers. There you yeah. go. You're like, exactly. Oh, it doesn't ask anything of you, but it's kind of fun and ridiculous. And this kind of came up on Anime News Network. They had some review of like, you know, best and worst. And I was actually kind of pleasantly surprised with some of their people because they kind of agreed with me, which made me feel good because you always feel good when people agree with you.
Yes.
But, you know, kind of two of the, I think Solo Leveling is fine. It's a good A1 show. It's better than Sword Art Online. It's similar in that kind of characterization and stuff, but it's better than Sword Art Online because it doesn't go into gross harem porn stuff, which is like, okay, so that's good. And it has some cool things, and there's some very nicely animated things. Overall, it's probably a little bit disappointing, but it's one that, again, is like, you know what? I'm fine watching it. It doesn't ask a ton of me. The leveling thing in it is dumb, but that's the whole premise. And it's kind of, you know, it's fun. But the one I think is my big disappointment has been Metallic Rouge. It started off good. And then I've kept watching it and I'm like, oh man, it's just, it feels like they threw like 800,000 ideas in this thing and didn't cut stuff down enough. And it's a bummer because I think the opening is awesome, but it's like, I get 5 minutes into the episode and I'm like, man, I just want to hear the end of the episode. I just want to hear the end song because I really like the end song too.
That's so sad.
Yeah. And then, just finishing up the shenanigans here is I also found kind of disappointed by Butchigiri. Like, it's fine, but I also kind of just went with nothing. So,
Yeah. Anyways,
we've run well over time on the pre-topic. So now we'll get into the actual topic here, finally, which is Streets of Fire. 1984 film. The summary is it's in kind of an alternate world that's kind of like Chicago, but it's in the 50s, but also kind of with the 80s. And there's a rock singer who gets kidnapped by a biker gang, and one of her ex-boyfriend, who's an ex-soldier, starts to gather a crew together to go rescue her and then duke it out with the biker gang.
Well done. That's pretty much the whole plot.
Yeah, that's it.
The reason why we went to this movie was because Mike Sensei suggested it as one because it has some non-trivial influences to things, particularly if you look at Bubblegum Crisis and a lot of other kind of 80s and that very neon, and then the mixture with the singing and kind of these weird, you know, worlds that are kind of like current world, but also kind of not.
Dude, that opening sequence is basically the opening sequence of
it, literally.
Crisis.
Yeah. Yeah. You just replace kind of rockabilly and, you know, 50s greaser style with 80s hair and, you know, distant future 20XX, and you more or less one-to-one have the, and obviously the type of music is a little bit different, but I mean, even like the mannerisms, right? Like, Ellen? Is that the
yes.
female?
Yeah, Ellen. AIM.
Ellen AIM, yeah. And the Ellen AIM and the Attackers, that's right. So, you know, it's just like, what was it? Was it Pris and the Nightsabers? Was that the...
Pris and the Replicants.
Yes. And the Replicants, that's right. And, you know, like the way she kind of like stamps her feet and pumps her hands, arm into the air, like, you
Dude,
know.
Her just, outfit, even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It, to some extent, yeah, for sure. And just how, like, the lights are, like, you know, going to the beat of the bass drum, like just a lot of themes, and like the big, you know, crowd, like all being, you know, super riled up and kind of, you know, ramp, like a little bit out of control, like very, very heavily influenced the opening, you know, scenes for like BGC, no doubt.
Yeah, that was the, I thought, this is obviously a lot of 80s, just 80s in general, but like McCoy's hairstyle, the mechanic girl, which you also see in like, boy, what's the other 80s thing? Decker and the one with the replicants, Blade Runner, right?
Yeah.
That kind of hairstyle, there too, was very much, very anime, seemed anime inspiration there.
Yeah. I'll, with that kind of on the intro part, I'll toss it over to Mike and say, is there any other stuff in particular on kind of the opening that you think is worth mentioning with this?
Just this huge set that they spent like $1 jillion recreating the look of Chicago on the Universal Studios backlot with like a kilometer long tarp or something like that.
That was a set? Wow.
Yes.
I thought they were doing location shooting for this. That's impressive.
Yeah, they did some location shooting, but they also had a huge set where most of the brawling took place.
Huh.
And
I wonder,
they covered it over with a tarp so they could shoot night scenes during the day on it.
Huh. I guess that explains why the movie was a huge flop as far as budget goes, because I guess it went over budget in that case.
Yeah. A lot of the reason it went over budget was building that set. Some of the reason it went over budget was they filmed an ending hoping they could get the rights to the Bruce Springsteen song Streets of Fire for the final song. And then when they couldn't do that, they ended up having to ask, you know, their songwriter for a new song, and he gave them the one they use as the ending song for the movie in, like, 2 days, and they had to rebuild the theater set to film that at a cost of another $1 million, so...
Wow.
Yeah, just a bunch of things didn't go quite right with this, unfortunately, and it kind of shows.
That's too bad, because, man, that now that I know it's a set, like, man, I was in love with a lot of just the settings, like, the overall, like, the old-style movie with the neon, a movie theater with the neon lights and stuff, like, I really... wasn't sure what to expect when you know, we were describing this movie as being a heavy influence for things like BGC. I was expecting something a little bit more dystopic in the cyberpunk space, not so much in the, I guess I described it earlier, like it feels very like rockabilly to me, like,
yeah,
not,
yeah,
very 50s, you know, styling, and I was like, oh, this is different, I maybe I can stick with it. And, you know, it was a very, very low bar movie as far as like plot, and I didn't necessarily mind that either. I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. I had its other flaws, but yeah. Sorry, Sam. I think I cut you off.
No, I was cutting you off. That's fine. I don't remember what I was going to say, but it wasn't important. I might have been going to change the topic.
Guess the other thing I'd say is that the movie very much gives the impression that it was meant to be a spiritual successor to The Warriors. But again, it didn't quite work out as much, but the same kind of pseudo-real, but also very extra kind of fantastical setting.
Well, it was the same writer and director who did The Warriors, but he did it before The Warriors.
Well, he did the movie itself 4 years after The Warriors.
Oh, was it? Oh, maybe I might have been. Maybe I got off. I thought I might be off there.
And in the meantime, he did 48 Hours in between the two, which was also a huge hit. So this really, the bomb of this came out of kind of nowhere because he had made some pretty hot properties before this.
Yeah, definitely correct. Warriors, I was off there. Warriors was 1979. Yeah, and then the writer and producer, they had this crazy idea for this, basically in the midst of when they were about to start shooting 48 Hours in like 1982 or so, and they started to throw this thing together.
And they were hoping it would be the first of a trilogy of movies centered around the main character, but obviously that didn't happen.
Yeah, it sounded like, you know, this is so. My info largely comes from, again, as usual, reading off the Wikipedia article, which is pretty well done for this movie. It's very well filled out with a bunch of stuff, but it sounds like basically they cast the lead guy, Michael Paré, as Tom Cody because they thought he was good there, and then it seems like nobody liked him or got along with him, and he didn't get along with anyone really at all.
Yeah, and the screen chemistry really isn't there for any of the relationships, unfortunately, which is one of the things.
Yeah, literally none of them have any chemistry at all.
Honestly,
Paré and McCoy have Cody and McCoy have the most, and they're conspicuously not an item.
Right.
Yeah, it was one of the things that I liked in the movie. I really liked the McCoy. She was a cool character.
Yes,
agreed.
And it was nice to have a cool female lead character who was not a, you know, sexual foil for the main person or anything.
Yeah, explicitly too. They cut that off pretty early.
Yeah,
and that was
real.
Nice.
She's like, not my type. Done. I was like, okay, cool. I dig this. I'm okay with this.
The part was originally written for a man, and actually they had Edward James Olmos in mind for it, but then the actress originally was, you know, auditioning for the role of the sister, which is a pretty minor role, which ended up going to someone from that Walter Hill had used in The Warriors, but other than a couple of cameos from The Warriors, or returning from The Warriors. The other one you might have noticed was the radio DJ, also, for those of us from the 90s, the chief on the Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego game show on PBS.
Oh, yeah! You're totally right.
Shows up as the driver of the subway train that's taking them out, or can't get back because of the fire.
Totally are right. Oh man, and rest in peace. I think she passed away recently, like very recently, like the last couple of years, I want to say, because Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego is like required watching for me after school.
Same.
But maybe we can go on to the casting, since we're talking about the poor chemistry, because there's a lot of notable names in this movie, like even by today's standards. I mean,
Willem Dafoe, a lot of them weren't notable then.
Sure. I think Rick Moranis probably was, right? Because didn't he do Ghostbusters, like, pretty much concurrently with this?
Yeah, but he hadn't had it yet. It hadn't come out yet, or at least at the point they were doing it. So he was pretty much only known for SCTV at that point, I think.
True, because this is like one of the least Rick Moranis characters I've ever seen him play.
Yeah.
Like, he was such a jerk. He did a great job. Like, he kind of did this pompous, you know, spoiled, like, I have wealth, so that's my power kind of attitude guy. And he did that really well. Like, at first, I was wondering how like, significant his role would be, because it seemed like he was just, like, the boyfriend that wanted to pay the goon to rescue his girl. But then he actually, like, stuck around the whole movie. I was actually pretty okay with that. I thought he did a pretty good job. So,
as far as people do in this movie, which I have my complaints about,
sure.
Kind of alluded to.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, let's be real. Like, this is not like, you know, Criterion watching or like a top tier acting per se. I had my bar set about as low as possible, which is probably why I ended up enjoying it more, because I think also, like, the plot didn't try to do too much. Like, it kept it real simple, which is probably the best. It kind of let the setting do the talking, which I definitely did appreciate.
Kind of had to go simple on the plot because they had such a... were throwing so much density at you in the setting, I think.
True, true.
I think that was the intent, yeah. I genuinely liked the visuals. I think the opening segment is definitely the, in my head, is definitely the strongest part of it, but they have a lot of other really cool visuals. I liked the scene cut thing was kind of cool.
That was so cool. I loved that. The wipes.
Those were animated
wipes. Those are really good cool. Wipes.
They were with definitely the trying to be MTV inspired at the time, which makes sense for 84. Like, yeah, one of the biggest differences between the Warriors and this is that MTV has come around in the meantime.
True, very true.
On the budget theatrical thing, like, it ended up with a production budget of like $14.5 million. I don't know what promotion was. I don't know if promotion back then was the same as it is now, where it's basically like double your cost for promotion. But the box office take was a low total of like $8 million. So
yeah, it was big oof.
Yeah, it was
apparently
a pretty big bomb.
It had tested well, but that doesn't always mean anything.
Yeah, it's hard to say. It feels like one of those things where they had their... It feels like as they were doing the movie, they kind of had the ups and downs. They're like, this script is trash. It's fine. The actors are great. They're not getting... Things aren't gelling. But we'll fix it up. We'll make it look good. But things just aren't quite there, but they are. And, you know, that kind of...
Yeah,
I think in the end, that came out in the box office of people being like, it's okay.
Yeah, like, they also spent, like, a month filming the sledgehammer fight at the end.
Jesus Christ.
Really?
It was that well, air quotes, choreographed.
And then ended up having to cut a bunch of that to get a PG rating, so... Just a number of things didn't quite come together, it feels like.
Probably spent most of that time picking those motorcycles back up every time they had
Wait. Yeah. This movie's PG rated? That cannot be right.
Well, remember, this was pre-PG-13.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess you're right. Because I'm just thinking of the scene in the, what was the name of that? Yeah, you all know what I'm talking about with the dancer.
It wasn't
much
pre-PG-13, but I feel like it was just squeaked in before PG-13.
Oh. Yeah, I'm going to say it would have been real close because it was, Temple of Doom was the first PG-13, I think, right? Or at least the first major one.
No, I feel like Temple of Doom was one of the reasons PG-13 existed and not was PG-13, but I could be wrong.
Okay. It was like EVA TV, where they're like, okay, you did that on TV, but you're not allowed to do that anymore.
Yeah. Last one.
Yeah, like, yeah, Temple of Doom and Gremlins were significant on that, I think.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Today I learned.
I think... Probably Temple of Doom too, because that as well, because that movie was huge and made had the box office thing to people like, all right, we got to make sure we get this actually set correctly. So I thought in terms of this, you know, as part of the AMO, this is definitely on the Otaku, because it's a movie that no one would think of really. It never was one of the developed like the Warriors did that. Cult cachet value to it.
Yeah, like, it's a cult movie, but definitely a more minor one than The Warriors, for sure.
Yeah. And it's not without reason, but also, like, the influences of things are evident. And there is a lot of cool visual stuff, like the things they put in there where it's kind of, it's this world where it's seemingly, like, permanently night and, you know, permanently nearly always raining. And I love anything in the 80s that was shot in Chicago, and a lot of their location stuff was in Chicago on the L and everything, because it has that Chicago look and down on some of the same lower Wacker Drive where they shot a bunch of stuff for Batman Begins down there. It's used a lot in places like that because it's a cool place, and I think they can also reasonably get it set up for doing movie shoots and stuff. Yeah, one of the things Diane Lane, who's Ellen Aim, like, this was, she wasn't really a known person there, and I think she was, at the time of the filming, was 18, maybe 19, so she was super young there.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and it's one of the things where they say that when they went to go casting, they're like, I think she's going to be too young for this, but then apparently she showed up with the good, with the right costume and stuff for the casting and really kind of sold it for everything. And then same with actually I don't know how old he was at the time, but he couldn't have been, I guess he was around 30. Willem Dafoe was around 30, so he was a little bit older.
30. He was like 31.
He's very, he was a very young looking 31.
Yeah, I mean, he went mostly shirtless for a good part of the movie that way. Can we talk about his costume in the first half of the movie? Like the weird yes. leather, like black pleather. I don't know. What's the best way to call it?
Like waiters, like, almost.
Waiters. Yeah. Good, yeah. That was interesting costume decision there. That part definitely looked a lot more 80s than 50s. But yeah, I mean, it was definitely in that way a very Willem Dafoe character, just kind of off. Something was off about him, and you could definitely tell. So
I feel like, to me, if I think over it all, I thought a lot of the acting was pretty hammy, and I didn't really like it that much. But I think he did a pretty good job, I thought, of being this kind of, like, psycho, but not overplaying it.
But not completely unhinged, right? Like,
yeah,
he was
right.
He was, like, always on, like, a low boil until the final, like, sledgehammer fight.
Yes.
I mean, that's pretty crazy too. Sledgehammer fight. I never want to get involved in a sledgehammer fight.
Yeah.
I would almost rather it have been the full scale, like, you know, gang war it was setting up to be, rather than a one-on-one sledgehammer fight. That just sounds like there's just a high possibility of disaster.
I would also like to talk about vehicle safety. And how every single vehicle in here was overloaded with the most... I think everything here was in an alternate world where every vehicle was hydrogen-powered.
Yeah, and they just all explode the slightest spark.
Yeah, anything touches the vehicle, they just completely explode all over the place. Vehicle explosions were as much as car wrecks in the Blues Brothers. Which was hilarious and awesome. You're like, this is kind of fun.
I mean, I love the use of, like, the 50s, 40s era classic cars. Like, that was for me, that was a design decision. I'm like, oh, chef's kiss. That was one of the visuals of the movie I really, really liked.
It was cool to also, the appeal, part of the appeal to me was it almost felt like the Romeo and Juliet in the 90s where they all had guns kind of thing. This one felt a little bit like a Western, but set in more modern times. You know, they've got the duel at the end.
Yeah, you're right. And the sheriff was even trying to get the guy to...
on a horse, on the subway.
Yeah. True. And the sheriff was even trying to, like, get the gunslinger to leave town before things got bad. Yeah. Like, that's true. Definitely. I see the, analogy there. So
when the one of the producers said about it, he was like, it was kind of one of those, like, you know, called it a teenage dream movie, where it was like, oh, this comic book hero with guns and cars and explosions and rescuing a babe and every single thing, and throw it all in there and it's gonna be a great movie
written by a teenager, I guess.
Yeah, it kind of has that feel a little bit. Which, you know, is fine. It's,
it wasn't boring, I'll say that.
Definitely was not bored during the movie, that's for sure.
No, and it didn't go overly long. It kept moving. It had its parts. I think that one of the things that I think is very different from, you know, where you think of, like, the Bubblegum Crisis, where I wasn't quite expecting Ellen to just get within, you know, as soon as she finishes her song, to immediately be kidnapped and attempted to be put into, to be made, what's his name, Willem Dafoe's Raven. Forced girlfriend for a couple of weeks, as he says.
Why? I didn't get that. Why he's like, why only 2 weeks? Why not forever? That was kind of weird. Did they ever explain that?
No, I don't think
he just wants some and then is bored, I guess. I don't know. It's weird. Likes variety.
That amount of self-awareness.
Yeah. He was very self-aware. He was a very self-aware kind of psycho gang leader person.
But yeah, kidnapping her right away is almost right out of a video game, which, speaking of which, this movie was hugely influential on the beat-em-up genre of video game, brawler games.
I mean, the visuals, to me, probably heavily influenced Kojima for Snatcher, I would have to imagine. I mean,
I'm not familiar with that. What's that?
Snatcher
game?
Is kind of one of the first, one of the early, like, visual novel type games that still had a little bit of action in it. Almost, not quite QTE, but like that style. It had a little bit of gameplay in it, so it wasn't just a visual novel. But if you look at the, especially when you compare it to the design aesthetics of the Streets of Fire movie poster on the wiki, which, by the way, I'm in absolute awe of. I adore this art style. The first thing I thought was, you know, a guy kind of in a duster with a, you know, double barrel shotgun. I'm like, yeah, that screams Snatcher to me. Like, for sure. And, you know, obviously, this is not Cyberpunk, where Snatcher is a lot more, why am I blanking on the most famous of Cyberpunk movie franchises? Blade Runner. Thank you. Yeah, Snatcher
like
is
earlier.
Yeah, is very much Blade Runner inspired with the replicants and stuff, but the design aesthetics, a lot of it, I feel like, were, you know, it uses still classic old weapons, like the big old Magnum revolver, right? Like, those are like two things that you kept on seeing. What's the main character's name? Cody Doo, right? He always had the double barrel shotgun kind of slung over his shoulder, and he always was reloading the Magnum when there was kind of like dead time in a scene, right?
So
looks like Snatcher came out in originally for
Sega CD, I believe, or maybe PC 98.
No, it was like for NEC PC or MSX2 in November of 88.
Oh, yeah, wow. That sounds right. I played it on Sega CD, so that was quite a few years later. But
yeah, it looks like Sega CD was in October of 92, and then it had a couple. And even actually, they say they kind of kept having a couple little things that actually got some sort of re-release on PlayStation.
I have the PlayStation remake of it from 2000. It was circa 2000 and probably four-ish.
This, according to Wikipedia, this says here PlayStation was there was a Japanese one in 96.
Oh, I'm thinking of the other one. I'm thinking of Police Knots. That's his other. Yeah. I have the Police Knots remake. Yeah, the Snatcher one was a little bit earlier.
But that's definitely a good point with the beat 'em up, and then also think of that visual thing of that idea of like, oh, we're in this city and it kind of looks like the normal city, but you know, if you go with streets not of fire but Streets of Rage, where you get a ton of the enemies are standing around fighting you in these weird leather get-ups.
True. Streets of Rage definitely had a lot of that, and I mean, that's one of my like all-time favorite game franchises, top to bottom.
Yeah, best, Final best Fight music. Also was at least somewhat inspired by it. I forget, it was the Wikipedia for whether it was Streets of Fire or Final Fight, but one of them, apparently one of the creators of Final Fight, like, denied having much connection to it in 2007, and then in a 2018 interview says, actually, I was told to watch all this guy's movies before doing it, and his special emphasis on Streets of Fire, but we didn't have much time, so we watched the three of them side by side on separate TVs at the same time.
Okay.
So it became this fever dream of all these movies combined.
That's so
wild. Yeah, imagine if you're watching The Warriors, Streets of Fire, and 48 Hours on three TVs at once. It must be crazy.
I guess that makes sense, because when you think about the sledgehammer scene, like, in beat 'em ups, like picking up random weapons and, you know, pummeling your opponents with those, became is a big theme. Streets, especially in Streets of Rage and Final Fight, like you get pipes and katanas and whatever else. But
and you eat food off the ground.
Yep. Eat trash chicken and trash apples.
So watching this movie, I actually started thinking of formulating a theory about the Japanese popularity. And Mike, you can tell me how possible maybe this is. And in that, I didn't like the dialogue. I thought the acting was kind of hammy and the dialogue was extremely hammy. And just the interaction between the characters, like we were saying earlier, there's no chemistry. But I was like, but I'll bet the Japanese dub is probably really good. And maybe that's why it's more popular over there. Not to say that that's all it was missing, but like, I think having better dialogue could go a long way towards making this thing more enjoyable.
They watched it subbed and didn't, you know, get the nuance of that, which is
very possible.
You know, kind of the reverse Megazone 2-3 and other 80s OVAs scenario that came over here and seemed way more awesome because people didn't 100% know what was going on.
I jumped over to the Japanese wiki page and immediately recognized for the four kanji for Tom Cody being voiced by Ikeda Shuichi. So I'm like, oh, well, there's already a huge upgrade.
Oh, yeah, dude.
Yeah.
Sign me up for that. I immediately went and checked the dialogue options in my rental copy, but it did not have Japanese. So
that's unfortunate. Because I could also see it as well being one of those things where with the dialogue being a little stilted like that, even in a subtitled one, you know, if you're not familiar with the language, it might, you know, it just might not feel as weird.
Yeah. I agree. That's entirely possible. Likely, even. Either way, it seems like the Japanese are getting a better experience, either out of ignorance or just out of having a better acting.
Yeah, I agree though. Like the that promo poster is great. It's so good.
I would not mind having that. I mean, it looks so much like Metal Gear Solid art. Like it's got, you know, it's definitely got enough resolution that you can tell that those are people. But you look really close and you see just a lot of like really rough lines and rough shading. Like,
dude, was this the original poster? Because I saw this on my Apple TV thing when I rented it, and I was like, this looks modern. That's unbelievable.
I think it was. It's not like it was popular enough to demand them making a new poster
for it. That's
the
theatrical release poster.
I want to know who the artist is. Like, yeah. I now wonder if this is the person they have that Kojima inevitably got to do the Metal Gear art, because this is so... I love the colors. It's just like the purples and oranges in the background. Like, I'm just like in love with this poster. Exponentially more than the movie itself.
Yeah.
But that's neither here nor there.
Well, once again, we're all, I think, as you know, I spent too much time on the pre-things. We're coming up towards the end of time, but it sounds like overall everyone is pretty up on the visuals in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, yeah, this movie looks really cool. It has good cuts. It's nicely shot. I think if you watch the opening segment, like there's a good reason it was nearly, not quite frame for frame, but a huge influence on stealing and turning into anime there. And then I think honestly more so than anime as we got into it is this has a huge influence on beat 'em ups and video game styling there. I think probably more so than anime.
That seems plausible.
Yeah, definitely.
At least that's my opinion. I'm welcome to be disagreed with there.
I mean, there's of course, like if you weight them, maybe like overall more diffuse influence on games, but like the direct influence on like Bubblegum Crisis is a
yeah.
Also, we never got the supposed original version of Aoki Uru. Well, we'll see if we ever get any version, but which apparently was. Like Yamaga supposedly pitched it as being Streets of Fire
with jets,
yeah, something like that, as the intended, you know, distant future sequel to Royal Space Force, which getting from Royal Space Force to Streets of Fire is interesting.
I mean, leave it to Yamaga to be able to do it, though.
Yeah.
Are they going to do like a Shin Sekai Yori on it and be like 1,000 years in the future? Everyone is in a leather gang.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I'd imagine if the movie ever actually gets made, which, given that I haven't heard anything about Yamaga since like before the pandemic, I'm
2018 is about the last thing I heard, and the last I saw was he was looking to find financing in like Singapore or something like that. What I was reading, but yeah, it's really sad because I mean, you know, 3 out of the 4 of us were in that panel. I was translating for it, and it was some
The art he had looked really awesome.
Yeah, I actually sat there and watched him draw that jet. It was. I mean, gosh, the staff he had lined up for it was, I mean, literally the dream team of all dream teams. I mean, you know, it couldn't have been more, like, hyped up. But yeah, just, I don't know, maybe it's better that it doesn't come out than if it released and it was bad.
Yeah, there is that.
Because we can romanticize, you know, what it could have been. But, yeah, well, we'll see.
Okay, so we can, I think, kind of go around and give good and bad on this movie, and I'll send it to Sam first.
Well, I mean, I think we've said all the good stuff, and I've complained about some of the bad stuff, largely being the dialogue and the acting. I guess if I want to get really nitpicky, I was those opening credits in the intro took way too long. I clocked it at like 15 minutes. That was kind of extreme. I did also want to compliment Rick Moranis on his very Osaka outfit. He definitely had that look. I really hope that his Japanese VA did gave him a Osaka Ben. Because that would have been really perfect. The money grubbing guy with the checkered suit and the glasses and man.
Wow, yeah. That's
really living that stereotype.
Interesting. I'll go with that. Okay. I'll put myself next. I think the good is the opening segment. Yeah, the bad is, you know, it's not the greatest film, but it's fine. It's one of those ones I try to think of, like, okay, would I recommend someone watch it? And I think I lean towards, you know what, if you wanted to have, like, hey, let's watch a fun, ridiculous 80s movie, I'd be like, oh yeah, dude, check out this movie. It's super dumb, but it's got some cool stuff about it. And you can, you know, play a drinking game to drink every time a vehicle explodes and you'll be messed up.
I feel it's more of historical interest, personally.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not one where I'd be like, oh man, I gotta watch this movie all the time. But the opening segment, I would totally just put that on and just watch that quite a few times, because it's really good.
Yes.
Alright, let's go to Nick.
Good is the music. I think overall, I love the song selection for the movie. I think it was probably its strongest point. Bad, I feel like we've all gone over. Like, I agree pretty much exactly with Sam. Overall, kind of rigid acting, not much chemistry. I will add, though, random factoid for one of the minor characters. So, the character Baby Doll, who's that, like, kind of that fangirl of Ellen's they run into towards the end, played by E.G. Daly, who inevitably became a actually very large voice actress in the U.S., doing roles such as Tommy Pickles in Rugrats, Babe the Pig in the Babe movies, and for me personally, I think probably the most impressive is she was Bubbles in the Powerpuff Girls.
Oh, wow.
So, incredible talent, ultimately. This was one of her early roles. She did a few live-action movies, but I think these days she's most definitely known for those roles. I mean, Tommy Pickles and Bubbles is, like, iconic, you know, American cartoon. You know, history right there. So, yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah, there's cool. A lot of pretty much all that you see. It's a crazy movie to look and be like, oh man, all these famous people. And you're like, they were not famous when they made this movie.
Yeah, it's like the Scott Pilgrim of 1984.
Yeah, it's so true.
Yeah, you definitely aren't getting famous people for a $15 million budget with as much of it as they spent on sets.
With a million of that budget being spent on a tarp.
Yeah, something like that.
Which apparently also caused problems because it would be blowing in the wind and making noises, and then there was birds that were, like, nesting on it. They were also making noises. So it turns out making a 1,200-foot-long by 220-foot-wide tarp did not work out great. All right, Mike, your final thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we've all covered most of it. I generally agree with you all. This is more an interesting movie to watch than, you know, an awesome movie to watch. But I feel like people who do go down the rabbit holes of certain things that were influenced by it would definitely have fun watching it to see some of the influence on those things, because visually it's a very striking movie. And audially, for that matter. The visuals and sound are great. It's a shame about the, you know, content.
Yeah, turns out scripts do matter, because everything else... Yeah, it's one of those things you're like, yeah, everything else was done quite well, and it just needed a better script and... I don't know, maybe some different casting, but maybe not. A lot of the actors were, frankly, pretty... Most of them were pretty good. Okay, so... With that, we're gonna close out. Next time, we will have a special report on a special episode, episode 50, on Tenchi in Tokyo. No, actually, it will be on Nick's return from Japan, because in between episodes he will be jetting off to Japan and back, so we'll get a fresh take from there for our 50th episode spectacular. So that'll be fun for everyone. And with that, I say thanks for listening, and until next time, this is AMO Kenzoku saying Saraba.